Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The tensions build and build over North Korea's missile tests and nuclear weapons. The island nation of Japan is caught in the middle, physically, literally, as in when North Korean missiles fly overhead and air raid sirens wail. But Japan is also caught up in its own deep-seated post-World War II, post-Hiroshima and Nagasaki aversion to war and the tangled politics with its neighbors and its ally, the U.S. This hour on Point, Japan and the North Korea crisis. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can you imagine waking up in Hokkaido to air raid sirens as ballistic missiles fly overhead? Does Japan need to start arming up to defend itself? Can it count on the U.S. to keep it safe? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Friday, here was the sound of the air raid sirens Friday morning on the Japanese island of Hokkaido as North Korean missile flew overhead, courtesy of Asahi TV. Later in this hour, we'll talk with the New Yorker's Evan Osnos about his recent trip to North Korea and what he learned about how Pyongyang and Washington see each other. But first to Japan. Joining me now from Tokyo is Motoko Rich, Tokyo bureau chief for the New York Times. Her story Friday was headlined, North Korea's threat pushes Japan to reassess its might and rights. You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Motoko Rich in Japan, in Tokyo, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. How's the Japanese public responding to missiles flying overhead? This, after all, the only country on Earth that has been hit with nuclear bombs.
So obviously, I mean, you played a little bit of the tape there of the sirens. It's pretty eerie, and they've been woken up pretty early in the morning. The first time this happened a couple of weeks ago, it was about 5:36 in the morning, and then they get alerts on their cell phones, and there are constant coverage on television all morning. So it's certainly a little rattling. But on the other hand, the Japanese public's pretty resilient, and by early afternoon last Friday when the missile had flown over, after wall-to-wall coverage on television, they returned to their baseball and their cooking shows. So there is a certain sense that the recognition that these are provocations, that there aren't actually nuclear warheads on these missiles that are flying overhead. So it's unnerving, but there's not sort of this great state of panic.
After the first missile test went over, the Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, put this statement out to the press calling the missile launch an egregious threat. Here was Abe.
The missile, which passed over our nation, represents the greatest and gravest threat to our nation ever. It also is an egregious threat to the peace and stability of the Asia-Pacific region.
Motoko Rich with The Times in Tokyo. Japan has, under its constitution, implemented after World War II, strict limits on its military capacity and reach. Can you describe those limits?
Right. Well, but fundamentally, they only have the right to self-defense. It's a so-called pacifist clause that was instituted at the encouragement of the United States occupation forces that requires that Japan is legally not allowed to do anything other than self-defense. A couple of years ago, Prime Minister Abe also helped push through some new laws that added a kind of layer of reinterpretation to that clause in the Constitution that allows Japan to participate in so-called collective self-defense. So right now there's a big debate in the country on what that means in terms of these missiles that are flying over from North Korea. Would, one, Japan be allowed to shoot them down if they were headed toward Japan? That seems to be, the answer to that would probably be most likely yes, because that would be a clear moment of self-defense. The more complicated question is, say these missiles were headed for Guam or for the continental United States, would Japan still be able to shoot them down? There are some that say yes. If we're allowed to do collective self-defense, that's what it means. We're helping our ally. Others say no, that would be clearly an offensive move.
Is there a move to reevaluate Japan's essential military posture given North Korea's rapidly advanced nuclear program, Motoko?
Absolutely. In the first instance, there's a pretty lively debate going on now, instigated again by Prime Minister Abe and his party, suggesting that, first of all, that Japan needs to increase its missile defense. So in the way that South Korea recently had an American missile defense system deployed there, which is known commonly as THAAD, Japan is now investigating what it should buy, and it would likely buy equipment from the Americans. So it currently has missile defense that can intercept missiles as they're on their downward trajectory, so when they're very close. And they also have missile defense systems mounted on Aegis naval destroyers. So these are ships that are surrounding the country that can also shoot down missiles when they're above the Earth's atmosphere. But most experts say this is not quite enough to really protect the country in the case of a genuine attack. So there is a discussion, and it's more or less settled that the Japanese government has decided that it's going to buy another layer of missile defense to put on land. The other question that's being debated is whether Japan should also acquire some kind of cruise missile that would allow them to strike at, say, a missile launch pad in North Korea. And then there's another more even complicated layer to that debate, which is whether, if they acquired these missiles, would Japan be allowed to fire them at the launch pad if it, say, detected that there was an imminent attack, that their intelligence or satellites detected that North Korea was about to launch missiles aimed at Tokyo or some part of Japan? Does the Constitution give the Japanese government and military the right to fire off these missiles to prevent that missile from even getting off the launch pad, or would they have to kind of wait to be attacked and then fire back?
Motoko, we have questions coming in for you, if I may, there in Tokyo. And if I may, let me take one from Portland, Maine. Todd, you're on the air with Motoko Ridge in Tokyo. Todd, you're on.
Hi, Todd.
Yeah, I might be mistaken. It certainly wouldn't be the first time. But didn't Donald Trump previously state that if any missiles were launched, that the U.S. military would take them out in flight regardless of where they were going?
Motoko, we've got a lot of people calling in about saying, why don't they just shoot the missiles down? Why doesn't Japan shoot them down when they fly over, or the U.S. for that matter?
Right. Well, for Japan, the government has said, because the two missiles that recently flew over were not directly targeting Japan, that their constitution wouldn't allow to shoot the missile down because it would not be an act of self-defense. And because these were missiles that were being tested rather than targeting any particular target, they weren't headed for Guam. They landed in the Pacific Ocean harmlessly. They decided that they didn't have the right to shoot them down. Moreover, they probably didn't have the technical capacity. By the time, it takes a lot of luck and precision to shoot down a missile, and by the time they would have been able to figure out where it was probably not within range of the missile defense that they have that can shoot it outside of the atmosphere. And the missile defense that they have on land can only shoot it if it's heading straight for them, and it was not.
There's a lot of skepticism about the technology here in any case, whether in Japan's hands or American hands, for that matter. Motoko, what about Japanese trust that the U.S. will stand up and defend it if things just get out of hand here? There's been an awful lot of hot language. We've got a lot of nuclear development in North Korea. Are the Japanese confident in the U.S. nuclear umbrella and in American protection?
That's an excellent question. I don't think the Japanese or the government are 100% confident, which is why they have constantly been seeking reassurance from the Trump administration. Prime Minister Abe has actually developed a very good relationship with President Trump, and they talk on the phone constantly. So after the first flyover and then the nuclear test, I think they talked twice in one day, which is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah.
I mean, when Obama was in office, President Obama and Prime Minister Abe talked maybe four times in 4 years, whereas President Trump and Prime Minister Abe talked four times in a week. And a lot of that is Japan seeking reassurance that the United States is committed to its ally, that it will protect Japan in the case that it's attacked. I think the concern is that earlier this year, in one of its tests, North Korea fired off four missiles. And again, they all landed harmlessly. It was a test, but it really woke everyone up because the thinking was, does any missile defense allow any country to protect it from multiple launches? If they really meant it, if they were sending four missiles straight for Japan, the question is whether technically they would be able to shoot them down.
Is Japan's concern that the United States would not turn to military action, or that it would?
Well, there are lots of different concerns. I mean, I think the Japanese public is against preemptive or preventive military action that has been discussed. On the other hand, Prime Minister Abe had a op-ed that was in the New York Times today where he said that dialogue has proven useless in the past. And so he wants the international community to put more pressure and tighten up sanctions, and that he also appreciates that if none of this works, there is a military option on the table. He's a little vague about what he means by that, but I think there is definitely concern that the military option would be used by the public, but I think the government has been talking about that they appreciate that it's there.
Is it possible that out of this era of North Korean nuclear action, Japan would move away from its post-World War II peace constitution ultimately and become militarized again? In the past, it was a real power.
Right. Well, that's a huge debate, and I don't think the Japanese public is quite ready for that. I mean, there is some inching and moving, recognizing the changed landscape. I mean, for 70 years, the country has enjoyed peace. And they have these threats both from North Korea and also from China, which has been doing some activity in the East China Sea, frequent territorial incursions with ships and so on and so forth. And so I think there's a lot of concern in the country about whether the landscape has changed and whether there is a need for the country to figure out ways to better defend itself. On the other hand, Japanese national identity is very firmly tied to the idea that it is a pacifist country, that they never want to go through what they went through in World War II. The Japanese left is very adamant that they don't want to be aggressors again as they were in World War II. So I think it would be a very uphill battle for the government to say, okay, we're going to totally militarize. On the other hand, I think pacifism is a little bit of a misnomer. This is a country that has a lot of sophisticated military equipment and 250,000 active duty troops.
Motoko Rich with the New York Times Tokyo Bureau Chief. Thank you very much for being with us today, Motoko.
Thanks so much for having me.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Japan in the middle of the North Korea nuclear crisis. Missiles flying overhead, Japan's choices, and its view of what's going on. You can join us this hour. Can you imagine waking up in Hokkaido with sirens blaring, North Korea's missile test in the sky? Can you imagine doing that as a Japanese, where they've known Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where they've been hit by nuclear war? And what will or should the country that bombed Pearl Harbor, then gave up its military might, do now? Will Japan stick with its peace constitution, its non-nuclear status, its dependence on the USA? Can the status quo last here? Here were President Trump and Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe at the White House in February. Standing side by side, the American leader said both countries have to beef up their military capabilities to meet the regional threats.
The U.S.-Japan alliance is the cornerstone of peace and stability in the Pacific region. It is important that both Japan and the United States continue to invest very heavily in the alliance to build up our defense and our defensive capabilities.
But many Japanese with real commitment to the long-time pacifist, no war please policies of their country. In August, the BBC talked with Japanese citizens about the North Korea and its missile launches. Here's one man. Says North Korea repeatedly launched missiles and doesn't seem to take any warning seriously. But this Japanese citizen says, I'm hoping the U.S. will not react too strongly and cause troubles. It would be Japan and South Korea that would be hit by damages, so I'm worried about that. And then here, this was Japan's chief cabinet secretary at a news conference on Friday after the latest North Korean missile flyover, Yoshihide Suga, with his view. As we cannot accept this excessive provocation repeated by North Korea, resolutely denounce it in the strongest possible words and also convey our people's strong resentment. Tough position for Japan. With us now from Tokyo, Yuki Tatsumi, Senior Associate of the East Asia Program at the Stimson Center in Washington. Yuki Tatsumi in Tokyo, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And with me in the studio is Thomas Berger, Professor of International Relations at Boston University, fellow at BU's Pardee School of Global Studies. He's been looking at military issues in Japan for three decades. Thomas Berger, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you for having me on.
Yuki Tatsumi, how would you describe the Japanese debate, conversation, dilemma as North Korea ramps up its nuclear program?
I think that, simply put, Japan is really in a dilemma. It really doesn't have a very good leverage vis-a-vis North Korea. Its bilateral relations with North Korea is really down to a minimal. They barely have no trade. There is really no economic transaction whatsoever. And moreover, North Korea just would not negotiate with Japan when it comes to nuclear or conventional arms or any kind of a missile posture with Japan. They always want to deal with U.S. and it's always Pyongyang's preference to deal with the United States on this issue bilaterally. So Japan really has to rely on the United States to engage North Korea, and also it has to, to some extent, rely on the United States to deter North Korea. Now I think the conversation is finally shifting into what else we should be doing, to invest in our own defense. But I think at the bottom line is, as long as Pyongyang always looks at Washington first and foremost as a negotiating partner, Japan has to rely on the Washington, and it can hope that it would also represent Japanese interest in that process. Mm.
Thomas Berger, 70 years of peace is a long time. It came after a period of heavy militarization in Japan and a long history of culturally of a kind of a military mindset. Can you see a change in the basic chemistry, post-World War II chemistry, or thinking about defense and military unfolding, maybe not overnight, but over time, as the U.S. appears to be in some ways in a retreat mode, as China rises, and now North Korea has nuclear weapons very close to Japan?
Well, it's not like Japan has been exactly unchanging for seven decades. Japanese attitudes have been shifting slowly for a long, long time. I mean, going back in the early post-war period, I mean, there was very strong sort of pacifist movement, never fight war again. But since at least the 1970s, Japan has been sort of step by step increasing its military capability, strengthening its alliance with the United States. And that's probably going to be accelerating as a result of these developments. I mean, Japan is not, it's as I think Makoto pointed out already to you, it's not that Japan is purely pacifist. They've got a large military establishment, $50 billion defense budget, advanced military capabilities. But they've been very, very cautious about how they use that military establishment. And I think that's shifting, new roles and missions.
Do you hear, Yuki Tatsumi in Tokyo, confidence in Japan that this North Korean situation can be diffused with diplomacy and sanctions? The Prime Minister's essay today in the New York Times seems pretty skeptical of that.
I think Japanese are indeed skeptical, and they have a good reason to be skeptical. In the last several years, talk over denuclearization of North Korea has, for lack of better words, pretty much stalemate, and has really no sign of making any meaningful progress. And in the meantime, we are now seeing in real terms, and Japanese are now seeing in real terms, the North Korea's accelerated pace in their provocative behavior, including they're just about firing off something every other week, if not in a less interval. That said, though, military option is really the least preferred option for Japan as well. I think Japanese gentleman who was on a BBC interview really put it out right that South Korea and Japan will be the immediate recipient of whatever the damage that or fallout that might come out of the any military action on the Korean Peninsula. So Japan really does not want another war breaking out on the Korean Peninsula, but at the same time, they are very skeptical of how of the prospect of diplomatic negotiations. But at the same time, with the lack of effective leverage on its own, they are really in a tight bind here.
Let's get a call from Lloyd in Dover, Delaware. Lloyd, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. The Japanese and the South Koreans, I think, would be the logical targets of North Korea's use of these missiles. They're continuing to try to expand their capacity, but even before they reach the United States, they've already proven they can reach Japan. And a threat to Japan would be a threat to America, which would really create problems. The Japanese had this peace constitution imposed on them at the end of the war. And as the experts have pointed out there, they've gradually been moving towards more and more self-defense. But it would seem to me that they're being forced into a position where, knowing that America hires a new executive, chief executive, every 4 to 8 years, they're going to have to develop their own extreme capability to respond in order to try to stop North Korea from using it against them. I think they're moving towards nuclear weapons and certainly have the capability for it, even though it's now still a big argument in Japan.
Lloyd, I appreciate your call. Thomas Berger, there are many who say, look, North Korea at this point, they have nuclear weapons. They're not going to be deterred. We can talk and talk, but ultimately they're going to become a recognized nuclear power. Maybe not happily, but just it will just be a fact. How does Japan deal with that strategically?
Well, Lloyd is quite correct that Japan has long had the ability to develop atomic weapons. In fact, during the Second World War, they actually had an atomic bomb. They had not one, but two atomic bomb projects underway. Didn't get too far. And Japan has the missiles. It has plutonium. It has certainly the technical capacity to put together a nuclear weapon in short order and probably build up an effective retaliatory capability within a couple of years at most, faster if we help them. But the Japanese government has been considering the possibility of doing this for decades. And time again, they've thought that the costs would outweigh the benefits. As long as they can rely upon the United States has far greater capabilities in the nuclear realm than Japan has or ever could even hope to develop. The atomic nuclear umbrella that the United States has put over Japan served during the Cold War when they faced a much more severe nuclear threat from the Soviet Union. So it's worked in the past. If Japan were actually to nuclearize, that is to acquire its own independent nuclear capability, this would create a whole host of problems. It would create a domestic crisis inside of Japan itself, because there are many people who are deeply, deeply committed against it, and would create a diplomatic crisis between Japan and its neighbors, beginning with China, North Korea. It might even create an incentive for North Korea to become more belligerent against Japan before it develops that ability. Problem with Russia. Problem with South Korea, which despite being having a common democracy and a common ally and many common interests with Japan, doesn't fully trust Japan. It would even create certain problems with the United States. Given these realities, as long as it is possible to rely upon the U.S. Nuclear umbrella, Japan would prefer to do that.
Yuki Tatsumi in Tokyo, is there a situation in which the interests of Japan and the United States might separate, might be different here?
Well, I think approach that I do believe that the North Korea is pursuing. We usually call it decoupling. The argument is that by North Korea demonstrating the capability that it can really now hit continental United States, it would put the question in front of American leaders of would we in the United States are willing to sacrifice, say, Guam or L.A. in exchange of protecting Tokyo. Or other parts of Japan, right now I think U.S. and Japan are very focused on making sure that that kind of a perception gap doesn't occur. They continue to work together on the enhancing Japan's missile defense capabilities, as Motoko said earlier in the program, and Japan also continues to invest in its own defense. This kind of a conversation would definitely take place in the context of the U.S.-Japan alliance consultation. And then I'm pretty certain that this kind of issue does come up when the Prime Minister Abe talked to President Trump after the every single action of a North Korean provocation. So for now, I don't detect any sense that the Japanese are very, very worried about this. But that's certainly North Korea's goals, though. So North Korean goals, though, to create such a suspicion on the part of Japanese, and certainly to some extent on the part of Americans.
Thomas Berger, what about that decoupling possibility? It sounds like a nightmare scenario.
Well, it's a very
which will be L.A. or Tokyo? How would that emerge?
Well, I mean, we can imagine various types of scenarios, but. We could imagine some sort of incident on the border between South Korea and North Korea developing. It could escalate. So let's say the North Koreans sink a South Korean ship again, as they did in 2010. This time the South Koreans retaliate. The North Koreans then launch attacks all along the DMZ, the 38th parallel. U.S. forces then would begin to deploy into all the U.S. forces in South Korea, but we would be using our bases to launch airstrikes, our bases in Japan. But
Yokohama and more.
Yokohama. And then we could imagine the North Koreans could launch a strike against one of those bases, let's say against Yokotsuka, which is a major U.S. naval base near Yokohama. And if they were to use conventional weapons, I'm sure we would retaliate with conventional weapons. But then there's the fear that North Korea, this is a complete sort of science fiction scenario, but North Korea could use weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons or even atomic weapon against, let's say, U.S. military facilities, and then warn the United States, if you retaliate with nuclear weapons against North Korea, we will take out L.A. And that moment, incredibly risky and scenario and dangerous thing for North Korea to do, but in that moment, you could see them trying to drive a wedge between the United States and Japan and South Korea. So that's the kind of nightmare scenario.
We're talking about the pressure the North Korea nuclear crisis puts on Japan and the U.S.-Japan alliance. Brian in Lexington, Kentucky. Thank you for calling, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think we all need to take a deep breath and not get into an arms race. Japan really needs to depend on the U.S. to lead this thing and appeal to the United Nations to put more pressure on North Korea, as well as India, their second-largest trading partner. And we need to get the IAEA in there. We need to get the whole world behind our side, including Russia and China, India, all of the United Nations, and all of NATO. And we need to have complete change and elimination of a nuclear program. If all else fails, we need to overthrow the government and get rid of the current leadership. And that's just what needs to be done. We don't need to ever... Look, we have one atmosphere. We share one small planet. I called this thing Operation One Small Planet when all this started. And the whole world needs to be involved. We got to share one atmosphere.
Brian, we've got it, and we're breathing it, and I appreciate your call. I mean, the stakes are high here, and deep breath sounds like a great idea. At the same time, Thomas Berger, there Japan sits with so much at stake. I mean, they're not far from North Korea, and they don't have their own countercapacity at this point. So I just wonder about the pressure this puts on their existing posture and how much change appears possible or even likely how soon.
Well, I think that as Motoko and Yuki have pointed out, you know, everyone in Japan is taking a deep breath. When we had that first missile test flying over Hokkaido, sort of response in Japan was Masaka, which means I can't believe it. And then the second time it was Mataka. What again? I mean, people are sort of taking it in their stride. Japan has lived with a nuclear threat before. I mean, North Korea has not had nuclear weapons, but they've had ability to cause problems for Japan. Soviet Union had ability to annihilate Japan. China, since 1964, has had the ability to attack Japan. South Korea has been living on the edge of the volcano for decades. So it is possible for countries to come to terms with this kind of situation and not panic.
Yuki, does Japan have the capacity to push for the diplomatic channel to open even wider and more effectively on North Korea? Do they have diplomatic leverage here?
Unfortunately, that's where their dilemma starts, because particularly with Prime Minister Abe, that he put so much emphasis on the what we people in Tokyo knows as abductee issue, which is the North Korea kidnapping a Japanese citizen to train their own agents, which occurred 30 or so years ago, And there are still some Japanese citizens who have been, who are kept in North Korea. And Premier Abe put so much stake on this, and it was actually on this issue that he became a political rising star in Japan, that Japan conditions everything in its engagement with North Korea with the resolution, what they call as a resolution of the abductee issue. But no one has quite defined what that resolution would look like for Japan. And for now, Japan's official stance is that we need to have an accurate account for every single person that we, the Japanese government, has confirmed as missing in North Korea. But what we really don't know whether that's even feasible at this point. Because
and all that at this point overshadowed increasingly by the nuclear question itself, even though that's a deeply emotional issue in Japan. And we understand that very well. Yuki Tatsumi, Senior Associate at the East Asia Program at the Stimson Center, with us today from Tokyo. Thank you very much for joining us, Yuki.
Thank you for having me.
And Thomas Berger, Professor of International Relations at Boston University. It's great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk with Evan Osnos. He's just back from North Korea, thinking about the center of all this. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Well, in all the hard and frightening talk of war and nuclear attack, how well do Washington and Pyongyang actually understand each other? Not well, writes the New Yorker's Evan Osnos after a recent visit to North Korea. He is with us. You can join us. What's your question for a top flight reporter just back from North Korea? Lots of talk over the weekend and, of course, for weeks now about North Korea. Here was Secretary of State, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation with a message for the North Korean regime.
Our strategy has been to undertake this peaceful pressure campaign, we call it, enabled by the four no's. The four no's being that we do not seek regime change, we do not seek a regime collapse, we do not seek an accelerated reunification of the peninsula, and we do not seek a reason to send our forces north of the demilitarized zone.
All the no's, all the things the U.S. doesn't want to do, which should be, the Secretary of State indicating there, reassuring to North Korea. And here was Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., where the president is today, big speech tomorrow. She was yesterday on CNN's State of the Union and asked about North Korea. She said that the U.S. is trying all diplomatic means, then asked if she stood by President Trump's threat to unleash fire and fury on Pyongyang. She basically said yes, saying when diplomats stop talking, the generals step in.
I think that the fire and fury, while he said this is what we can do to North Korea, we wanted to be responsible and go through all diplomatic means to get their attention first. If that doesn't work, General Mattis will take care of it.
Well, that sounds simple, but of course it's not. Joining us now from Washington is Evan Osnos, staff writer for The New Yorker. In North Korea in late August, his letter from Pyongyang ran in last week's issue. It's called On the Brink, Could Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump Goad Each Other into Nuclear War? You can find a link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Evan Osnos, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Your piece has been read all over the place, people talking about it like crazy, and you've been talking about it a lot. As you speak with Americans about the North Korean situation, are Americans asking the right questions? What are you being asked that you are happy for? Or what's missing, Evan?
Well, I think the question that comes up most urgently is a good question. And a lot of people have asked me whether Kim Jong-un is crazy. That is, I think, the thing that people are struggling to understand. Why would a leader of a country pursue a confrontation with the United States that could so obviously threaten his own regime's existence and his people's livelihood and their health and their future? And the answer is that he is, by all accounts, meaning according to the U.S. intelligence community, according to the national security community, and based on my own experiences in Seoul and Beijing and in Pyongyang over the course of the last month and a half, is that he's not crazy in the way that we think that. He's not mad. What he is pursuing a very confrontational approach to promoting what he regards as his own national interest. And first and foremost, in his mind, is protecting his regime's ability to defend against an American attack. So for him, that's number one, and that means being very, very aggressive.
You write about the risk of nuclear war Is there some restraint that you can feel on both sides here that in the end would lead North Korea away from actually using these weapons and put severe constraints on the U.S. wanting to get into that realm? Or are we really on the cliff's edge?
No, I think you make a crucial point, Tom. I actually think that we are not as close to the edge as it can feel to us every day when we flip on the TV or reading the latest headlines. The truth is that on both sides, there is a recognition of the profound, I mean, literally unique risks associated with the moment that we're talking about if you're actually talking about a nuclear exchange. And I'll give you a specific example. On the North Korean side, he will do these extremely provocative things. They'll threaten us with all kinds of rhetorical mayhem about breaking the windpipes of the Yankees and so on. But if you actually look at the conduct of Kim Jong-un's regime over the last few years, there is a tendency for them to threaten a lot and then to actually not do the most provocative thing. Specifically, they threatened to attack South Korean NGOs, non-government organizations that were pushing propaganda literature into North Korea. But when it came time to it, they didn't actually attack the NGOs. They attacked the balloons that come across the border, which is a very benign, kind of isolated way of expressing their rage. In the case of the United States, we call for fire and fury, as the president did. The idea that he would bring violence to North Korea, but he is, in the end, operating under the same principles of mutually assured destruction that have governed the nuclear arsenal since 1945. There is, and in my interviews with members of this administration, you know, the president is speaking the way that Donald Trump speaks. But when you talk to the people who are involved in this on a daily basis, down to the most granular detail, they are deeply aware of the risks that could that we're facing, and they are not cavalier about it. So I think it's useful to actually temper some of this public public fear with the reality that on both sides there are people who understand the grave risks.
What did you find most reassuring, if we can use that word, in Pyongyang, your time in Pyongyang, and what did you find most unnerving, Evan?
I'll start with the unnerving side because there's a lot of that, and I think it's worth telling people about it because it's unusual. I mean, when you go anywhere in Pyongyang, there is a reminder of one kind or another of the possibility of war. So on billboards beside the street, or you'll see on billboards, you'll see pictures of missiles crashing into the U.S. Capitol. My host, which was the foreign ministry, took me down into the subway system in Pyongyang and said, this is where we would go in the event of a nuclear strike. It's designed to defend us. So that's unnerving because it just seems like their level of fixation on the possibility of war is so profound. However, what's useful to remind ourselves, there's a domestic political purpose and a foreign relations purpose for them in promoting that message. They want to promote the idea for domestic purposes that the U.S. is an existential threat. That's how they kind of gain strength and maintain strength at home, keep people focused around a regime, even when their lifestyles trail behind the rest of the world. And then they also, of course, want to project this very tough image to the world. The encouraging thing is that life goes on in North Korea. And I think this is the hardest part for people to picture from far away. It's such a closed and secretive and paranoid country. They don't let anybody in to see it very often. And as a result, we don't have much of a picture of it. But I can tell you that when you're there, you're not gripped by a sense that these are people in a suicidal, sort of mesmerized by a suicidal mission the way that we have become accustomed to seeing in jihadist movements. And we've almost become used to the idea that there are people who see valor in suicide. And that's not North Korea. People there are watching smuggled South Korean film and television, and they are trying to imitate the styles that they see outside the country. And, you know, there's a black market in real estate where people are buying and selling apartments outside of state control. So there is this, in some ways, outside of the nuclear confrontation, there is an aspiration for life. And that's crucial. That's absolutely vital in understanding it.
Let's take a call or two for you, Evan, if I may. Jim in New York, Saratoga, New York. Jim, you're on the air with Evan Osnos.
Hi, Tom. I'm deeply concerned about the situation, mainly because of who we have as president now. And I noticed that I got on the Internet this morning, it was either CNN or MSNBC, reported that Russia and China were going to conduct joint naval maneuvers off the North Korean coast. And I'm wondering, is that designed to scare us off, or was it designed to intimidate North Korea?
That's interesting. I'm reading that same report here, Jim, from The Independent, that Russia and China have begun at this point big military drills less than 100 miles from the North Korean border. You've got Chinese warships in Peter the Great Bay just outside the Russian port of Vladivostok for joint naval exercises that will extend in the Sea of Okhotsk north of Japan. Evan, I don't know if that's beyond your strategic purview here, but who are they speaking to with these exercises?
Well, I don't know specifically, but I can tell you that my suspicion is that these are more intended to send a message to the United States than they are to North Korea, partly because China and Russia have been actually facilitating North Korea's ability to get around sanctions. They have been, as you know, they've been putting the brakes on efforts to put greater pressure on North Korea. Some of that is changing. They are allowing more pressure on the North Korean regime. But right now, it would be strategically inconsistent of them to be wanting to send too much of a threat to the North Korean government. They may be sending a modest threat. But ultimately, when China and Russia act together, and I've seen this over a number of years of living and working in Asia, it is generally intended to send a message to the United States, which is usually back off.
You don't have free range here. Artem in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're on with Evan Osnos. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Evan, glad you don't think Kim Jong-un is crazy. I agree with you. To kind of add to your last caller, you know, isn't this a conversation about China, Russia, and the United States? Don't you think if we all lined our interests up and we got together, we can get North Korea to calm down, maybe give up their nuclear weapons? You know, I feel like we've been starving them for 50 years. What can we expect from a sovereign country? And don't they have, don't they need their nationalistic pride like every other country?
If China, the U.S., and Russia all aligned their strategic interests, that's a big if. But we'll look at it, Artem. I appreciate your call, Evan. That's asking for a lot, but you hear the plea.
Well, it's a key point, which is the role of China and Russia. I think the idea that we would get all three of our strategic interests aligned is probably a heavy lift. But in the short term, and I'm writing about this right now, as a matter of fact, China is evolving on this question. I mean, China is beginning to see the situation in slightly different terms than it did even a couple of years ago. As many people know, China and North Korea used to regard themselves as lashed together, allies that were in lockstep. The old phrase was that they were, in Chinese, as close as lips and teeth.
Yep.
And that's no longer the case. The truth is China now regards their North Korea's behavior as a real risk in the region. And for that reason, China is willing to put more pressure on North Korea, not what the U.S. wants, but more pressure. And that's a meaningful change.
But toward what? I mean, after spending time in Pyongyang, do you believe that North Korea would give up its nuclear weapons program? And if not,
no.
Then how do we get to a sort of a safe-feeling, tolerable space here?
I don't believe they'll give up their nuclear program, and I think that's clear. My visit left absolutely no doubt of that, and it's confirmed by everybody who I've talked to who has substantive contact with North Korea and studies it in a serious way. So what are we going for? Well, the answer is it's going to be some form of de-escalation in the very short term and then containment in the long term. What that means is trying to get them to stop regarding their encounter with the United States as a trajectory towards war. That's the first step, meaning some form of diplomatic contact, some form of the lowest level of reassurance. Look, we're not going to get into a situation where the president of the United States is sitting down with Kim Jong-un. That's not going to happen for a long time. And the reason it's not going to happen is that it would require everything else has been achieved beforehand. That's sort of your, you know, that's your closing round.
Yep.
But what could happen is trying to get them to freeze their program, to stop testing, to agree to some terms under which they would continue to develop their program. That's the reasonable goal in order to build some sort of coexistence framework with them, deterrence and containment. That's where we're headed at the moment.
And yet, your headline is all about risk, and the piece ends up really talking about brinkmanship. You write, you say, in 18 years of reporting, I've never felt as much uncertainty at the end of a project, a feeling that nobody, not the diplomats, the strategists, or the scholars who have devoted their lives to the subject, is able to describe with confidence how the other side thinks. That's kind of incredible. What's the biggest gap in comprehension or the dimensions of it that you see?
In some ways, both sides are dealing with a black box on the other. On the American side, very knowledgeable scholars in the government, analysts, people who have studied Korea for a very long time, and then some others who are national security generalists, but at the very highest levels, people like H.R. McMaster, who spoke to me for the piece. I mean, they are looking across at North Korea, and they don't know the answer to the most essential question, to the most basic question, which is, what does Kim Jong-un want? Does he really just want self-defense? Or would he, in fact, use the nuclear arsenal to reinvade South Korea or to push the United States off the peninsula? That's a huge unknown. If you can't answer that question about your adversary, then you're dealing on very uncertain ground beneath your feet. And on the North Korean side, they're looking at Donald Trump, and they don't know the most basic question. They don't know the answer to the most basic question, which is, under what terms would he actually use nuclear weapons? With previous presidents, they've been confident that the president would not use nuclear weapons. But Donald Trump has deliberately, by his own description, sought to project unpredictability. And for that reason, they are very confused, partly because they see multiple voices coming out of Washington. They see that it's not just the president who talks, but sometimes the Secretary of State, sometimes Secretary of Defense, and oftentimes with different messages. So there is a gulf of incomprehension on both sides that surprised me, and I was a little bit uneasy about the questions that the North Koreans were asking me about the United States, because they suggested that there are a lot of big gaps in their awareness.
We just got half a minute. Donald Trump has indicated that that confusion or uncertainty can be used to advantage. Does it look that way to you?
No, I'm afraid. I think that uncertainty in this case is not helping his cause. It's making it harder, and sending a clear single message would be the best thing that the United States could do at this point.
Evan Osnos, back from Pyongyang and North Korea, and writing at length, strikingly, in The New Yorker, on his experience and observations there. On the Brink is the headline. Evan Osnos with us from Washington. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're there for you and right here every day. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.